Welcome to Voices in Value-Based Care. I'm Matt Fusen. Thanks for tuning in. The movement of value-based care is revolutionizing how healthcare providers get reimbursed for delivery of care. On this program, we explore stories from the field about how real organizations are dealing with this change. You can follow the show on Twitter at hashtag VoicesInVBC and follow SPH on Twitter at SPH Analytics. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn. Typically, at this point, I would introduce my guest, but today we're going to do something a little different. Recently, our president of population health at SPH Analytics, Kevin Weinstein, hosted a fascinating panel discussion on the impacts of COVID related to quality measurement and population health, both as COVID is ongoing and the post-COVID world. We're lucky to have a panel that represents a payer, a provider organization, and a consultant that works across both. Now, let's go to Kevin as he introduces our panel members.
And thanks to all of you that are attending, and thanks to our panelists. I'm Kevin Weinstein, and I'm the president of the Population Health Business Unit here at SPH Analytics, and I'm excited to have you all with us today as we together evolve as an industry in response not only to the COVID pandemic, but also towards value-based contracting and value-based care in the world that was before the pandemic. So what I'd like to do is invite our distinguished panelists to introduce themselves today and just say hello, and then we'll use our time to ask a couple of questions and kind of around the panel format. Let me invite Dr. Amy Helwig to introduce herself first, and welcome Dr. Helwig.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you this afternoon. Again, I'm Amy Helwig, and I'm currently the Chief Quality Officer and Vice President of Provider Performance at the UPMC Health Plan here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And we're a large regional health plan, originally community-based health plan, but we've grown quite a bit. We have 3.4 million members now, and we have all lines of business, including commercial, Medicare, Medicaid, and long-term support services. In my role at UPMC Health Plan, I oversee not only all the regulatory aspects of quality and all of our programs such as NCQA and CAHPS and HEDIS, as well as all of our state requirements, but also have oversight over the quality and outcomes programs in all of our value-based payment programs, not only for primary care physicians, but also for specialty physicians. And I'm delighted to be with you here today.
Great, Dr. Helwig, thanks so much. Dr. Hsu, would you mind saying hello? Dr. Hsu from Emory.
Sure. Thanks, Kevin. I'm Joel Hsu, Chief Medical and Chief Quality Officer for Emory Healthcare Network in Atlanta, Georgia. Been in this role for the last couple of years, and we have about 200,000 covered lives in our various health plans. And, you know, my role is to oversee the quality and financial performance of the network.
Great. Thank you. And last but certainly not least, I'd like to ask Dan Marino, who is a industry expert and consultant, to say hello to the attendees.
Hi, Kevin. Hello, everybody. Happy to be here. As Kevin mentioned, in my consulting practice, I work with organizations all over the country on helping them to consider, you know, how to transition into value-based care, what their strategies look like. Over the last number of months, we've spent a lot of time working with organizations on different programs such as telehealth and really responding to a lot of the COVID-19 activity. So really excited about sharing that with a lot of the folks today.
Great. So why don't we go ahead and get started? And Dr. Helwig, if you don't mind, I'd like to start with you. And just ask, given the regulatory relief that in some ways has been offered to health plans as a result of COVID, how are you changing either your program or your approach to the quality measurement? What's different for you as a quality professional from the health plan as a result of some of that regulatory relief and changes?
Good question. Well, I think COVID is interesting in its timing in that it actually is not affecting just one quality regulatory year, but it's affecting multiple years. So if you first just want to look at the quality year that's currently wrapping up, So as a health plan, we proceeded with full HEDIS, full submissions for all of our lines of business and just completed that last week. And so we didn't make any changes at all there. You know, we continue to aggressively pursue the chart abstraction for a medical record review. And with CAHPS, again, even though CAHPS became somewhat optional for some of our programs, we again went ahead and completed our full CAHPS survey for all lines of business and are just now in the process of receiving those results. So we're just going to continue as normal, and we'll have to see what we already know. The NCQA is not going to have ratings. We know there's going to be some adjustments to the CMS stars, but certainly in terms of our day-to-day operations, to close out this quality year, we did not make any changes. But then if you look at the current calendar year that we're in right now in terms of working with providers and office visits and working with our members in terms of closing gaps, you know, that's a little different. So there, I think we're just very similar to other health plans in that we're really looking to try to maximize virtual care and really looking to promote out to our provider network, making sure that they know all the different measures that you can close the gap in terms of virtual or telehealth, making sure they know the billing codes and all the programs and reimbursement changes that have changes so that they can continue to maximize their ability to really reach out to our members and deliver the needed care. We also have done quite a bit of work thinking about care coordination and how do we start to deliver care in settings other than the acute care hospital. So knowing that that's not necessarily the you know, place where we want folks to go if they're going to be at risk of being exposed to certain things with COVID, really we have to think differently in terms of, all right, how do we make sure that we're meeting all the needs of our members by finding ways to deliver care to them wherever they may be. In the community or in their home, and making sure that we're still meeting their needs and figuring out creatively how to innovate and how we can reach out in different mechanisms. And then finally, I think we recognize that our provider network has very significantly been impacted, and they're really just thinking of ways that we can continue to very progressively support our primary care providers in particular. And again, in different mechanisms that we can do that so that they can continue to see our members in any way possible or reach out and interact with them.
As you think about reaching out to providers, Dr. Helwig, and just a quick follow-on conversation, do you find that the providers are getting same, similar, different, conflicting advice from their other payer partners as well? And are you fighting for attention, or is everyone fairly well aligned when you're reaching out into your provider network?
Well, when we reach out to our provider network, some of our programs are government-based, you know, a good amount. So certainly the guidance that we're receiving from the federal government, that's going to be consistent across the country. And then with our Medicaid programs and our other state contracted programs, we're getting very clear guidance from our state. So again, for us, it's just making sure that we're very consistently getting that out to all of our providers, but the various payers won't have any differences within the government programs. And the commercial, I think, the commercial space is really kind of more making sure you're aware of what the other health plans are doing and aligning whenever possible.
Great. Well, thank you. But let me ask both Dr. Helwig and Dr. Hsu, you know, are there, as a result of COVID and maybe in anticipation of not only this, but perhaps the next such thing, are there specific quality measures or things that you think are going to be kind of requested changes that now might be added to what we measure when we try to measure quality? Are there things that, as a result of the last 4 months, you anticipate now trying to capture information around?
Well, I think when I think of quality measures in particular, I think the NCQA over a year ago, I mean 2 years ago, already had been indicating different measures that could be addressed and met by telehealth. And in fact, they're really quite, I would say, generous in terms of if it doesn't specifically say that it can't be done via virtual visit, then assume that it can be done. But I don't think we necessarily, you know, we did some promotion, but I don't think providers really, I said, we're ready to grab onto that and see that as really a viable way to give care. And what I think we've seen now in the last several months is providers really beginning to accept virtual and much more readily. And, you know, it's not for everything. I think we all agree that. So you can't give an immunization virtually, right? You know, if you think of certain pediatric visits and things, And there's certainly a benefit to being able to do certain things, you know, face-to-face and have certain types of conversations. And there's certain types of exams that you actually can't do virtually. But I think we have a whole new awareness of there is a distinct role for virtual health. And in terms of patient convenience and patients being able to get care that's very accessible to them wherever they are, you know, and not having to, you know, drive and have to pay for parking someplace and maybe find childcare and so many other barriers to care that have existed. I think that whole area is now, you know, I think people will just be much more accepting of, you know, we can also hit our quality measures with this. So I don't know if there's going to be that much more expansion, is maybe just more awareness of what everything already can be done with virtual visits in terms of how it relates to quality. I do think there's areas that we certainly have caution on that we are still trying to figure out, you know, is that right? So I there's been things that have been circulating indicating that, you know, that there may be more antibiotics prescribed than what we really feel indicated. And that may be happening a little bit. So I think we have to keep our eye on antibiotic stewardship. And there's other aspects as well. And I think that we realize that, you know, there is some things that really are better done in person. But I think in terms of patient access to care, I think it's just been tremendous in terms of being able to lift that. And we know from some of our provider offices that under virtual care, their no-show rate is pretty slim, if at all. So again, really kind of addressing some of those barriers to care that now have been overcome by a greater acceptance to virtual visits, and I think a lot more access to specialists as well. So I think some of those things will be long-term impacts that we can look forward to.
And Dr. Hsu, do you see, you know, either capturing different information as a result, and kind of different measuring different things as a result, and then also just because Dr. Hellwood talked about it so extensively, you know, how do we measure the quality of a telehealth visit? Do we do that any differently? So maybe a couple different aspects of the same question.
Okay. Well, I would say that on June 5, NCQA did put out a notice on 40 different measures that are now accommodating telehealth. I wouldn't say that there's changes to the quality measures themselves. And, you know, so while telemedicine is clearly expanding, we had a market survey not long ago that showed about 40% of people still kind of want to wait for a physical visit and aren't comfortable with the telemedicine platform. Now it's something new, you know, so it's, you know, I think we have to actively promote it as a viable option for certain kinds of things and not just wait for it to achieve market acceptance on its own. You know, but right now that's still a problem. And, you know, we have to actively as a community really promote telemedicine visits.
Got it. And any thought on your part of how you capture quality for a telehealth visit? Do you use the same measures as you would for a physical visit, or do you pop up a survey at the end? Like how else might you capture?
The documentation is all the same. You know, so even with the telemedicine visit, the required documentation elements have not changed. You know, so we can still see all the same discrete data elements. And in terms of the patient satisfaction surveys, those have not changed either. We have made modifications to our intake in terms of getting, you know, patient reported conditions and changes and things like that to make it where they can do it on their smartphone. Kind of eases the process in. But overall, you know, the quality measures and documentation requirements are all the same.
I would just echo that. And I know that as a health plan with our requirements around caps, the base cap stays the same, but I think we are very interested in exploring additional questions that we can add to our caps that aren't required ones, but are just of interest to us because we want to know how people have been using virtual health and how it affected their access and how it affected their experience. So for that, for us, it's additional learnings on top of the base.
Great. And Dan, let me ask you a question. And, you know, are there certain things that payers or providers should be doing now to kind of not wait until the end of the year to kind of understand where their performance is and understanding that everyone is at a different kind of measurement spot, but are there other things that we should be thinking about as either a provider organization, as a payer, to address kind of the likely continued impact of the pandemic here from a quality standpoint or from a population health kind of management standpoint?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I think, you know, right off the bat, one of the things that we're talking with our provider partners about is having the conversations with the payers right now as to what the level of reimbursement is going to be for telehealth services and get that confirmed. You know, right now, CMS put out that the telehealth visit is being reimbursed the same as an in-person visit. We know that that's going to change. So it's important for the providers to begin to have that conversation with the payers ahead of time and solidify that. The other thing that we're starting to see too is for a lot of the hospitals and the, you know, the ACOs that are in value-based contracts, we're seeing a lot of deferrals until the next year, but there are opportunities to engage in, you know, sort of a shortened performance year, ways to be able to get some of those performance dollars in now. For one of our clients, which I thought was an interesting perspective, they, you know, with COVID and being able to manage the population, they're starting to look at a lot of the publicly available data related to how the COVID cases are managing or influencing those patients with chronic diseases. So they're actually advancing their ability to provide care management and integrating that data into their platform. So they're not only looking at patients with chronic diseases, but the influence of those as it relates to COVID. What we've been talking with them about is to make the case to the payers to say, you know, look, we're expanding that. We're really focusing on our population health components, and we need some dollars in the door. So we being able to have that conversation now allows for the hospitals and the ACOs to get some of those performance dollars in and not wait for the next year. I think the more that the hospitals, the ACOs, the providers can be proactive in those conversations really helps. The data though, Kevin, is really key. Understanding where to start and how to form the ask is really key.
And maybe building on that, I can ask both Dr. Helwig and Dr. Hsu from the, both the provider and the payer perspective. And one of the things that the industry conversation has been about is, you know, the volume-based impacts from the last 3 months have really exposed the fragility of a fee-for-service model. And I guess my question for you, both from a payer perspective and a provider perspective, is, you know, do you see value-based contracting accelerating as a result of it? Do you see more of a willingness? Do you see more collaboration between payers and providers? And maybe Dr. Hsu, I'll start with you, and then Dr. Helwig, would be great to get your thoughts on that as well.
Okay, sure. So in terms of, you know, what we would push now, we're not that nimble with our contracting to be able to ask our payers to change contracts on the fly. You know, usually it takes like a year to negotiate that agreement, sometimes more than a year. You know, so, and especially if we're asking them to pay us more money, you know, I don't think they're going to be willing to do that now. But on the other hand, this may be the one time where profitable fee-for-service systems wish they were in capitated contracts. Unless you're in a market like New York where there's so much COVID, you know, we have enough that it shuts down our healthcare systems, but we don't have enough that it's failing our hospital beds. You know, so I think it kind of points to, and some of our senior leaders are recognizing this, diversifying your portfolio, fee-for-service, as well as some risk-based contracts, you know, could kind of help weather some of these ups and downs.
Dr. Yeah. Helwig, your perspective?
Well, I think that we certainly have providers and payers will always have ability to come together and agree on quality and outcomes. That's kind of a nice aspect about the quality spaces. We have general agreement in terms of what we are both have as common goals and the patient's interests. And I do think that the value-based payment programs will accelerate because I think there definitely we saw that, well, fee-for-service, there we knew there were flaws with fee-for-service beforehand. We knew there were inherent reasons why, you know, it really was holding us back in terms of how to do population health and alternative ways to give care. And I think with COVID, we didn't have a choice but to have to move to that population health model and to start thinking, all right, what do we do with care coordination? What are we doing to make sure that better identify our members at risk and make sure they're still getting their needs met if the traditional care centers aren't there? How can we still connect with people? And that's really what population health is all about. It wasn't traditionally supported in a fee-for-service model, so there wasn't really that heavy incentive to want to go there. But that's essentially what, you know, a capitated contract is about. It's not about, you know, limiting care. It's really about figuring out how do you best deliver care that's aligned with the patient's needs, where they are, and how to deliver it most efficiently, and not being so tied up to having it have to happen in a distinct office where you can bill it as fee-for-service. So I think providers now have all gotten a taste of, you know what, there are other ways to give care, and, you know, there may actually be some other, you know, unintended benefits of having some of these other types of contracts that are not fee-for-service. Again, whether it's to diversify your portfolio or just to kind of increase the flexibility in how you want to deliver care and to have alternate ways. And so I think that's really the neat thing that I'm hoping that enough people have had a little bit of a taste of, that they may be willing to go that step now and think, all right, maybe it is ready in a way that we weren't before to move to some of these more risk-based or capitated contracts.
The question to you, Dr. Hsu and Dr. Helwig and Dan, combining a couple of those elements around flexibility, new tools, new ways to interact with patients. One of the things that I've heard being discussed increasingly is kind of the evolution of population health as a discipline from being very much kind of where we were in a pre-COVID world, which was, you know, very cohort driven, right? We have a package of patients or a cohort of patients, let's describe them as our pre-diabetics, to a world now in a post-COVID environment where we have much more flexibility, perhaps in contracting, perhaps in kind of care access, to now where there's the opportunity to further isolate isn't the right word, but to kind of come down out of cohort and kind of almost manage patients in a mass customization way, so that the plan and approach for 10 different pre-diabetics is actually different, but empowered by kind of an automated platform and process. And so, yes, they share that pre-diabetic condition. In a pre-COVID world, you would have managed them all the same, but is there any notion to the idea that now there'll be more increased pressure to manage at that next level of detail down and to try and really create a much more customized plan? So I'd love to get your thoughts.
I think that maybe in the last 5 to 10 years, when we talked about precision in medicine, I think traditionally we're thinking of precision drugs, pharmaceuticals, or new genetic therapies. And that was kind of our idea of, like, you know, that same drug isn't always right for everyone, because some people are going to have some adverse side effects from it and others won't, and some people get benefit and others won't, and really trying to use our data to drive who best to match the right drug or the right genetic treatment to. So we've done a lot of work there, and I think that the same thing can and should be applied to population health. So, you know, with everything else in terms of what is the best intervention for that diabetic, because all diabetics and all pre-diabetics, they're not the same. And it's really beginning to think, all right, with this diabetic who also has these other conditions or not as conditions, living in this type of family situation in this type of geographic region with these types of resources available in the community, what is the best way to package all that together into a data-driven, precise intervention that really matches what not only what the patient needs, but what they're able to do in terms of changes and medications to really advance their health to their fullest. So it's really kind of the same thing, except we've never really thought of it on a population health basis. We've had lots of energy on the pharmaceuticals and genetic treatments, but it's just reframing and shifting it. And I think that's just definitely the way to go.
Dr. Hsu, you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. So I would say that we would certainly not say we treat everyone the same, because everyone has an individualized care plan. But at the same time, there are evidence-based measures and evidence-based therapies. And as a system, we do want to try to promote using the evidence-based therapies, instead of having something where we say it's so customized that we're not really driving a unified platform. You know, and examples would be antibiotic use for UTIs. years ago, everybody used Liboquin, and now that's changed. And now you're not supposed to use fluoroquinolones for that. You know, so while we're not treating everybody the same, we want to drive common, known, evidence-based therapies.
Great. Great. Thank you for that.
That was a great discussion and provides some insights into what actions industry leaders are taking during COVID and beyond. It was interesting to hear Dr. Helwig talking about adding questions to their CAP surveys about telehealth experience and value in advance of those being added officially. Leads me to think that how many changes are going to be driven from a quality measurement perspective and a patient experience perspective by payers and providers looking for information prior to those measures or questions becoming required. I think we're going to see quite a bit of that just because of the urgency to get that data back with such massive changes in how care is being delivered. It was also interesting to hear Dr. Hsu talk about the realities of contracting and noting that even with a desire to diversify payer contracts and move further from fee-for-service, it's a long and complicated process. I agree that this shift won't be accomplished overnight, but I do believe COVID is a change agent that will drive value-based care at a faster rate than if we had not seen the pandemic occur. I'd like to thank Kevin Weinstein, our President of Population Health here at SBH Analytics, for hosting the panel, as well as our panelists, Dr. Amy Helwig, VP of Quality Improvement and Performance at UPMC Health Plan, Dr. Joel Hsu, Chief Medical Officer and Chief Quality Officer at Emory Healthcare Network, and Dan Marino, Managing Partner at Lumina Health Partners. You can learn more about the show on the program page of healthcarenowradio.com and lend your voice to the conversation on Twitter at #VoicesInVBC. And be sure to follow SBH on Twitter at SBH Analytics. I'm Matt Fusen, bringing you the voices in value-based care you should hear. Till next time, have a great week.